Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, as Lebanon's parliamentary elections for a new president is delayed once again, how is the Middle East's so-called best democracy being influenced by outside forces? And will Lebanon's confessionally-based politics survive the upheaval? And some are calling it the new gold rush. How the latest land grab for unclaimed territory underwater is making waves. Parliamentary elections for a new Christian president of Lebanon have been pushed up to November 12th, the second delay of the elections, which were to take place this past Tuesday. Lebanese politicians are deadlocked over the selection of the new president, who under the country's constitution must be Christian, while other lawmakers come from the nation's other faith communities, 17 in all. Pope Benedict has been watching events unfold in Lebanon with concern and has called for peace there. Lebanon is home to one of the Middle East's largest and oldest Christian communities. A string of bombings, a violent conflict at a Palestinian refugee camp in the north, and at least seven political assassinations have taken place in Lebanon since the former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri was killed in February 2005. Well, Lebanon's Maronite patriarch, loyal to the Pope, has held a series of talks with legislators to try to find agreement over a presidential candidate. But Christians are practically equally divided in their support of the country's Western-leaning government and its choice for president, and those who support the pro-Syrian opposition leader, General Michel Aoun, who is also backed by Hezbollah. In Resolution 1559, the United Nations Security Council declared support for a free and fair election in Lebanon, according to its constitutional rules, and without foreign interference. So, what influence or interest do foreign states exactly hold in Lebanon? I put that question to the Secretary General of Caritas Lebanon and attorney Fadi Ibrahim.
Let me say it this way. From the beginning of the state of Lebanon, all the elections were managed by the foreign powers. Let's say from the beginning there was France, and after France we had Syria, and after Syria we had America, and after America we had everybody, the United Kingdom. All the major states or major countries in the world, the big countries, are interested in, are involved in the Lebanese affairs because they think that Lebanon is a crucial point or an important point in the geopolitical map of the Middle East, and especially that Lebanon is made from 17 different community, religious community. And so this variety makes him from time to time very weak.
Well, in fact, I know that people there are very, very polarized as to those who feel the government, the current government, is supported by the West and by the United States.
Yes.
Those on the other side who believe that the West and the United States are evil and that the country cannot be associated with them, and they are looking towards Syria and Iran. Do
yes.
you see any agreement or any consensus on any of the main issues, you know, for the good of Lebanon here?
Yes. I'm not sure if I can give you an appropriate answer or something accurate, but what I'm thinking about is we are a part, a major part, an important part of the Middle East crisis, which means many of the Lebanese population, people are involved, are interested in the Palestinian affair and the Palestinian problem. And Israel as well is moving, let's say, army and intelligence bureau or something like this in order to keep Lebanon in trouble or mismanagement of its political side. For the time being...
So in other words, you're saying that there are foreign interests who are trying to keep Lebanon destabilized.
Yes. I'm talking about the main cause of the Lebanese crisis. The West countries are supporting the cabinet of Senora because they are allied with the American way of thinking or the implementing of Israel in this area. On the other hand, we have Hezbollah and the other party of Lebanon, who is supported by Iran and Syria, and they are the sole countries who refuse to have Israel in the Middle East, in the area. Last week, a friend of mine, he told me that Lebanon looks like a monopoly game. It's like a monopoly game, and the players are foreigners, and the Lebanese are the soldiers of the game. This is it. We used to be like this from the beginning of the nativity of Lebanon, since the French mandate here, and still till now, all the Lebanese are allied or are, kidnapped. The public opinion in Lebanon is taken by both the West or the East. I'm talking about America, France, Great Britain, or Iran, Syria, and the other countries.
You were mentioning there the nativity, so to speak, of Lebanon under the French mandate.
Yes. I'm interrupting. Lebanon is born in 1919. Before that, there's no Lebanon. It was the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire. After a meeting with France and England, and we call this convention Sykes-Picot Convention, the Sykes-Picot Treaty, so they designate the borders of Lebanon and all the area, and we were from 1919 under the control of the Republic of France. And we had our independence in 1943, and from 1943 till now, all the major problems in Lebanon, let's say the war, the presidential election, the nomination of the cabinet, and every important event in Lebanon was all the time managed by foreigners or by foreigner countries or by two different mentalities, the West one and the East one.
But since the French mandate, it was France who established the political system based on a confessional differentiation of the political parties. The president is going to be always a Christian.
The Maronite, more than Christian, the Maronite. We have Orthodox or Catholic here, but the president is always Maronite.
Then the Speaker of the House is always a Shia, and then the Prime Minister is Sunni, right?
It's Sunni, yes.
So do you think that this confessionally-based political system is destined to fail?
I think that all the politicians here in Lebanon, we're trying to find a solution for every single problem faced with them. But for the time being, it seems it's going to be tough a little bit. And after the Hariri assassination, everything were gone in a different way. Before this, the country was in its first step. All the politicians, all the historical politicians, are thinking, let's say, patriotism. But for these times, I'm not seeing this way of thinking. Everybody in Lebanon, everybody who is like me, who is not involving in politic matters, is seeing, everybody is seeing that the way how all the leaders, the political leaders, are trying to do is a personal approach. It's not a patriotic way of thinking.
What are people feeling on the street? What is the atmosphere there in Lebanon? Do people fear more assassinations of lawmakers?
Everybody is upset. Everybody here in the streets is waiting for the election. Everybody is living with fear of the future. The future is black for the time being. And we are waiting for a new president who will take us or lead us to the peace in this country. All the assassinations made in Lebanon from 2005 till now are related to foreign decisions from the UN.
Wait. What do you mean by from the UN?
I'm not saying that UN is made, but every resolution made by the UN against Syria or against Iran or against Hezbollah or against I don't know who gives a fear between among the Lebanese population that an assassination will take place.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that after the UN passes a resolution,
yes,
giving greater...
After or before, just in order to make pressure, to give pressure on the UN not to condemn Syria or not to condemn Iran or whatsoever. This is a kind of inner black way of thinking in the Middle East, the political assassination. And everything is related with the politics. The assassinations are not familiar with the Lebanese mentality. It goes with the United Nations resolution against Syria. Everybody is accusing Syria with those assassinations. Everybody is accusing Hezbollah on these assassinations. Everybody is accusing a third party who nobody... till now, we have like 14 political assassinations, and the Lebanese government did not get one single information about the executor of these assassinations.
Fadi Ibrahim is Secretary General of Caritas Liban. Some are calling it the new gold rush, the last land grab to extend national territory, but this time it's underwater. Russia plants a rust-resistant flag under the North Pole. Britain wants rights to a huge wedge of the Antarctic seabed and another possibly off the Falkland Islands. Canada announces it was stepping up controls of shipping lanes and planning military bases in the Arctic Circle. The underwater land grab is making waves. While under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, nations can claim seabed rights to areas which prove to be a continuation of their sovereign territory's continental shelf. Countries have until May 2009 to stake a claim to extend their territorial rights. But Australia's National Director of the Catholic Apostleship of the Sea, Ted Richardson, is concerned the planet's oceans, what he calls the last frontier, stand to suffer from the underwater gold rush.
One of the things that they're doing is highlighting that they want to claim these territories. Whether they're able to or not is still up for debate. There's a lot of research has to go into the study before each nation will be granted an extension to their existing limits. At the moment, each country has a 200 nautical miles around it, which is their sovereign territory. They want to expand that to 350. Now, that means at the moment there is 38 million square miles of marine environment that is controlled by the nations of the world. If we expand that to 350, That takes us to 50 million square miles of seabed. And there's many of those miles, more than an extra 40-odd million miles, which has no surveys, no study. It's too deep to study. It's too vast. And, we don't have the technology. We have ships that can sound the bottom, ships that can even drill at that depth for oil and shale oil and things like this, but nothing that we can do to say, okay, if we start dredging this stuff up to say, okay, there's minerals and there's things in here that we can use as a nation to make us more wealthy, what are we going to do to the environment? What are we going to do to the fishing? Because all of that silt will wash up. Every the nutrients that feed our fishing and habitat comes from the deep. It doesn't come off the shallows. It all washes up from the world's currents. I think the United Nations need to step back a little bit from this and say, until we can develop some way of mining this area and doing it safely and doing it environmentally, then we shouldn't be just saying, okay, this is your water. When the time comes and the technology is there, go for it, because we've already given you the right to it.
So what you're concerned about is the huge economic benefits that countries expect to reap from mining and from oil drilling in the deep seas.
Exactly. You know, there's a huge amount of resources there in an area that we don't know anything about. We know more about the moon's surface. We know more about Mars and what makes up Mars than what we know about our own deep sea. We know very little about our deep sea. We know very little about our currents. We know very little about the environment that's there, other than what comes through an 18-inch glass window on a robotic submarine. We think, hang on, we don't know enough about our sea environment and what's going to happen here before we start digging it up. I just see a catastrophe just looming because we don't know enough about it. We didn't know enough about what damage we're doing to the ozone layer until all of a sudden, hello, we've got a hole there. We've got big troubles, big problems. Are we going to wait until we've got something as disastrous as that in our marine environment before we can say, we can't do this? We need to investigate it really seriously. And the studies and the ability to do those studies is not there yet.
Officials here in the Vatican are concerned too. Now an official with the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Monsignor James Reinert spent many years with the Holy See's Permanent Observer Office to the UN in New York.
The Holy See is an observer to the Law of the Sea treaties, and that includes fishing, that includes the territorial rights, it even includes piracy and those kinds of issues, anything to do with the sea and shipping. What I was most heavily involved with was the seabed treaties, and this was something that the Holy See felt very strongly about, was that the open ocean, the seabed, the mineral rights, the exploration and exploitation of the seabed was for the benefit of all mankind. And in that saying was that a developing country who couldn't and had no real ability to drill for oil in the Pacific, we'll say, or the South Atlantic, or wherever it might be, or a landlocked state that had no ability to have access to the open ocean, that the exploration and exploitation of the open ocean, those parts of the ocean that no one claimed as their territorial waters, anything found there, anything that would benefit mankind, would be divided for all mankind. And at one of these meetings, a delegate came up to me and said, "Why are you here? Why is the Holy See involved in this? Why are you interested in it?" And my response was that we're here to make sure that you get your fair share, that's my interest here. We don't have an interest. The Holy See doesn't have an interest in what goes on, except for the fact that we are part of mankind, and we want to make sure that the developing countries can have a share in this.
There are so many financial, economic interests here involved. I mean, is it realistic to think that way out in the oceans and seas, so far from the coastlines, this is a common heritage for everyone?
Well, no, I take it the other direction, that out into the open ocean, that yes, it is the common heritage, and how can you then claim as a nation, and I will use the example of Greenland, that you have a claim now in the South Atlantic because there's a mountain range that runs, and again, this is just theoretical, or that in Russia, that your mountain range goes from here to there, and so you have a claim on this area. Well, whose mountain range is that? Just because it crosses your country, we have the Rocky Mountains that cross through, you know, all the way up through Mexico and the United States and Canada. Well, then who can claim that that mountain range goes on into the Arctic Sea, and so that's our territory? That's where it becomes difficult, and that's where I think that all of this is going to become very murky, and in 2009, after the deadline, when the tribunal starts to look at these things, I think that we're going to see a lot of these things thrown out, that they'll just be tabled and say, you know, okay, you've made a claim, we have it on record, but that doesn't mean anything. That's my feeling, because in a way, I think that they're stretching the letter of the spirit of the Law of the Sea Treaty way beyond what anybody thought that it would be when they were formulating it. And in a way, I think that this violates both some of the provisions of the Law of the Sea Treaty and the Antarctic Treaty. I think that there are some people who are going to have to look at these very, very closely and say, you simply can't do that.
You come into all sorts of difficulties when you get into areas like the Malaccan Straits, or many of the straits around the world. They will be covered by two countries or three countries. Who sails through those waters? What happens through those waters? Who can fish through those waters anymore is now all up in the air. No one really knows how that's going to work as well, even if we disregard the deep sea, just the areas where countries are very close together. And then we get on to small countries. How do small countries afford to do these very, very expensive surveys? Small island nations and these sorts of things, are they going to be lobbied by big mining countries to say, okay, we can do the survey for you, but you sign up for all the rights to the minerals and resources are there and we'll look after you? It doesn't bring you into a global family. What we have is a global village, so to speak, and if we look at ourselves as a global village, as mankind, we have a stewardship responsibility to care for our environment, to care for our planet, and it has to be done universally. It has to be done together. I just think this is a grab for the last frontier by individual nations who are not looking at a complete picture of the world, of humanity and life. And I think if we can step back just a little bit and say, let's look at this together, let's not just cut up the sea into individual blocks for individual countries and say, this is my sovereign territory now and not yours, and you've got to ask my permission before you can even sail through it. It's crazy. The sea has always been a free place. It's always been something that's given to us by God, not owned by any country or any nation. I think to expand it beyond that takes that away from being God's gift and being now we control what God gave us. God's creation is now under our control.
One place where that control has had a positive spin-off to some extent is the Antarctic, protected since 1959 by the Antarctic Treaty. Signatories to that convention agreed to safeguard the Antarctic from exploitation of its natural resources and to cooperate in scientific research on the territory. But will the Law of the Sea Convention stand to be just as successful?
Article 11 of the Seabed Treaty talks about the open ocean and what can and can't be done, and if there is going to be exploration or exploitation, that how the benefits of that come back into, first of all, into the Secretariat of the International Seabed Authority so that they can be distributed among the other nations that can benefit from this then. The Antarctic Treaty, it is important, and it has been kind of a benchmark treaty for the safeguarding of what the Antarctic is. My fear would be that if that breaks down, if countries who have been signatories of that for almost 50 years say, well, we'll repudiate the treaty, that we're not, you know, we'll break it, we're not going to be parties anymore. The real horrors that could lead to in, you know, one of the provisions is you can't bury nuclear waste on the Antarctic. Well, okay, we're going to pull out of the treaty. Now we can bury nuclear waste in the Antarctic. We can use that as a dumping ground. You know, that's one of the real fears that if all this starts to unravel because of this, because of people staking claims, that this is something that we should really be concerned about. Personally, my greatest concern is that there's a possibility that some of these countries that have signed not just the Antarctic Treaty, but the Law of the Sea Treaty will pull out for the sake of being able to exploit energy resources in the Arctic or in the Antarctic. And what that could mean as far as the treaty itself then falls apart, we'll see changes in fishing patterns and the changes in all sorts of things that have to do with the oceans and transport and all of these things. Commercially, for developing countries, it could be really a disastrous thing if the treaty can't hold on to itself and hold on to its parties.
Monsignor James Reinert is an official with the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. And earlier you heard Ted Richardson, the National Director for Australia's Apostleship of the Sea. This programming note for our Rome listeners, starting October 28th, this program will no longer be broadcast on 105 FM, but you can still catch it on the same days at the same times on 93.3 FM. Again, that is same days, same times on 93.3 FM. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.